Judge Cochran, Judge Jessen, Judge Sleeter, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have six cases on our calendar today, three oral and three non-oral. The oral cases are being heard by Zoom in accordance with pandemic-related orders. The first case on the calendar is A-19, State of Minnesota versus Jordan Lee Watcher. Hopefully I pronounced that name correctly. The standard rules will apply to this Zoom oral argument. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Marshall will keep the time and you can see, hopefully see the time in one of the squares on your screen. If there's any technical difficulties, I will ask the marshal to stop the time so you don't lose any time due to any unforeseen technical difficulties, but hopefully that won't occur. This oral argument is being recorded by the Court of Appeals. And just a friendly reminder that other recordings are not permitted without the advance permission of the court. So counsel can proceed when you're ready. I'll ask that counsel introduce yourself and the party you represent for purposes of our recording. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Jordan Wachter. Your Honors, today we are asking this court to reverse Mr. Wachter's guilty plea, and we raise two issues in our brief. First is the accuracy of Mr. Wachter's brief, and the second is the sufficiency of the inquiry to determine Mr. Wachter's competence before accepting his guilty plea. And if I may, I'd like to start with the second issue in our brief, the competence issue. This issue kind of presents a question about whether the district court conducted a sufficient inquiry into appellant's competence in light of his active diagnosis for schizophrenia. So the answer to that question of what kind of examination is sufficient is, well, more than nothing, which is what we saw from the district court in this case on the issue of the defendants.
If I may, I just wanted to to get your perspective on what the district court knew during the plea hearing that, you know, might or might not trigger the need for further questions about competency, because, you know, I know you rely on some of the things that are in the PSI, but that was done afterwards. When I look at the transcript, that what I saw was your client acknowledged that he had been in a mental hospital at some point in the past, was seeing a psychiatrist, and was taking two injections. I didn't see any discussion about schizophrenia. Could you just share your perspective on that with me?
I think you have an accurate view of the record, Your Honor. The actual word schizophrenia does not come up until the PSI, which is introduced presumably before the sentencing hearing. It is important to consider what Rule 20 says, which is that a defendant can't plea or be sentenced if he's incompetent. So the relevant inquiry of this is the entire proceedings. And also keep in mind that the entry of judgment of conviction is not entered until sentencing. The fact that this, what's that?
I just want to understand kind of what level you would suggest it requires further inquiry into competency. You know, is it anytime someone says they're seeing a psychiatrist and taking medications that then the district court has a duty to basically, you know, order Rule 20 or at least make a detailed inquiry into competency? Is that your position?
I'm not advocating for any kind of bright line rule. I acknowledge that a lot of this is a fact specific inquiry. But keep in mind, Your Honor, Rule 15 requires the district court judge to ask whether somebody has been a patient in a mental hospital. And the boilerplate questions in the plea petition require the court to wonder or to inquire whether they're actively taking medication and things along those lines. So, if the answer to those questions is yes, I think that the district court is at least required to ask some follow-up questions. It would not make sense for the district court to be required to ask those questions, but not be required to follow up. So We're not advocating
I'm sorry. Just so I'm clear, you're arguing that the mental health diagnosis and the fact that he was receiving treatment by itself is enough to require further inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor. Further inquiry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, further inquiry, but not necessarily a full-blown Rule 20 evaluation. The district court, for example, in Bonga 2, there's two Bonga Supreme Court cases. The second one is an example of the type of colloquy that the court can engage with the defendant, counsel, the prosecutor, and consider any other evidence on the initial question of whether there is reason to doubt the defendant's competence. And if the district court concludes after that colloquy, no, I'm satisfied that there's no reason to doubt competence, then they can move forward with the plea. But if they do have reason to doubt competence under Rule 20, they are required to order the mental health professional to conduct the competency evaluation. So the area that we're focused on for this issue is the degree of inquiry that is necessary before court can decide whether there is reason to doubt. And the trigger for that inquiry is our affirmative answers to those questions in the plea petition. And again, that's the reason those questions—
So let's look at that in a little more detail then, because here, and I just want to make sure I understand what exactly it is that gives rise for the need for further inquiry in your view. Because here in the plea petition, appellant indicated he had been in a mental hospital in 2006, which was a number of years ago, that he is currently being treated by a psychiatrist or other person for a nervous or mental condition, and that he has not been ill recently, and that he has been taking his medication. So I'm wondering how does that information indicate some need to inquire into competency when it appears that he's, you know, it's been quite a while since he was in the hospital due to mental illness, and it appears that he's actively being treated and has not been ill recently?
To answer that question, Your Honor, I would focus on I call them the DROPE factor. These are these factors identified in DROPE and echoed in Bonga and Camacho and Bauer and all of these cases that talk about evidence of the defendant's irrational behavior, demeanor before the court. And I think probably most relevant here would be the defendant's history of mental illness. So I think the very fact that he was previously hospitalized for a mental illness indicates a pretty significant history with mental illness. And the fact that it is currently being treated through regular intramuscular injection, I don't know if we can expect a district court to know this, but if you're getting injections of neuroleptic medications, is indicative of a psychotic disorder. I'm not aware that they treat mental illnesses through intramuscular injections for any other type of mental illness. So the fact that he is actively being treated requires the district court at a minimum to ask, what are you being treated for? The fact that this record indicates in the PSI and became available at sentencing that he was being treated for schizophrenia underscores the significance of the need for further inquiry. So had the district court asked, what are you receiving injections for? The answer would be schizophrenia. What are the features of schizophrenia? The fact that it is a delusional disorder, that it affects a human being's ability to make rational decisions and perceive the difference between reality and the delusions that exist only inside of his mind.
Mr. Wickdahl, can I just follow up a little bit on that just to clarify then in answer to Judge Cochran's question? It sounds like at most the PSI with the identification of a diagnosis underscores, but your main argument is that during the plea hearing, not the result of the PSI, is what you believe the record supports a reason to believe or question competency such that the judge should have inquired. Am I understanding your position correctly?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. It is affirmative answers to those specific mental health questions in the plea petition that exists for the purpose of triggering the court's requirement to conduct additional inquiry into that very important area, the requirement that a defendant is competent before he pleads guilty, no one would know unless you ask.
Can I follow up then a bit? This is maybe a little bit unique because it's early in the case, as I understand from the record, relative to most felonies where someone enters a plea. And yet most of the time, a Rule 20 consideration is in fact early in the case. But now in this record, as we look at it, because he enters a plea, because he signs a petition, because he does answer questions that seem to satisfy in their face his understanding of his options, his willingness to proceed. The public defender inquired of the usual questions, so forth. What do we do with that, which we normally wouldn't have in an arraignment or a Rule 8 appearance where an attorney raises the issue. There's a diagnosis, we have some question, and the judge might hold off, allow some more documentation, and then just has medical information such as the diagnosis that you're referring to. But here you actually have words from the defendant seeming to understand, notwithstanding the mental diagnosis, notwithstanding the history, what he's doing, what his options are, et cetera. How do we then come to a conclusion with that record that it was error, that somehow the court was required to inquire further?
Your Honor, the reason why you reverse is because Bauer recognizes the district court's duty to sua sponte, initiate that additional inquiry. It cites to a federal court of appeals decision and recognizes that when the district court has indicia, and I think they talk about in that case, they talk about chemical use, but I think the same applies also to evidence of mental illness. Bauer is what triggers the district court's responsibility to conduct that additional inquiry in light of the other evidence that is part of the record to determine whether the district court satisfied the requirement to ask enough questions about the reason to doubt competency. Those are all relevant. The way he answered questions in the factual basis and things like that are all relevant to that inquiry. But Your Honor, I think a close look at the factual basis during the plea colloquy here today does not support that Mr. Wachter is a competent and rational individual. He asserts that he outright asserts that he doesn't remember the factual allegations in the complaint. He vacillates between the factual basis for what he's actually admitting to. On page 10 of the transcripts, he says that he pulls the victim out of the house by her hand, and his attorney says, well, that's an assault too, which is not. And then later in the transcript says, well, I pulled her out by her hair, but I don't remember that. These are not concrete assertions that are evidence of a person understanding exactly what he's doing there today, or worse, what he did that makes him guilty that there today, guilty of that crime during that plea, I mean to say. So again, the entire record is relevant to whether it supports a district court's decision that there is no reason to doubt competency. So to answer your question, yeah, the whole record matters. Of course it does. But if the district court doesn't conduct any colloquy specifically into the mental illness of the defendant, and we know now from additional things in the record, like the PSI, what an additional inquiry would have produced, of course a district court could not have concluded based on the record that we have here today, that there was no reason to doubt competence. And that's what the remand would be for.
I guess part of my concern, if I may, is if we do, as you suggest, look at the rest of the record and say, what we found out, we would have found out he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and he was taking his medication for that and being treated for that, right? Wouldn't that say, well, I mean, it would be different if he found out he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and wasn't seeing a psychiatrist and wasn't taking medication, then I would be much more troubled.
So I don't actually know that the record indicates that he's actively compliant with his medication. It says that he's seeing somebody and that he's being treated. We don't know when his last injection was or when his next injection was due. We don't know whether the injections are actually effective in suppressing the delusions, or whether Mr. Wachter, even notwithstanding receiving those injections, is actually able to distinguish those delusions from reality, those very distinct features of schizophrenia. I think that we can understand that people respond to neuroleptic medications differently. And just the fact that somebody is seeing a mental health professional does not mean that they are competent. And that's why the additional inquiry is necessary. I don't think it's sufficient to conclude that that there is no reason to doubt their competency just because they're receiving treatment for a mental illness. So,
Counsel, if I may, I'd like to turn to the first issue just briefly. You don't have much time left in your initial argument. With regard to the accuracy of the plea, I don't see any indication in the record that the plea was intended to be a Norgaard plea. Would you agree with that, that the plea was not intended to be a Norgaard plea?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think that the plea would have to be a Norgaard plea in order for it to be valid, based on the defendant's repeated assertions that he lacked memory, maybe because of his mental illness, maybe because of his intoxication, maybe a combination, or, you know, maybe cynically an unwillingness to accept responsibility for his conduct. I don't know. I think that either because the district court did not follow the Norgaard.
I guess just to clarify, though, at the time the plea was made, there wasn't any discussion before the court that the plea was intended to be a Norgaard plea.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think the respondent's brief agrees with that as well.
So in our analysis of the issue, would you agree that we should not analyze it as a Norgaard plea?
That is correct. You should not analyze it as a Norgaard plea. I think this court can conclude that because it should have been a Norgaard plea based on the lack of memory, the plea was invalid. And if I may address in rebuttal, the absence in the record of any evidence to permit the conclusion that there was evidence of bodily harm, which is another element of domestic assault. But I should. Okay.
Yes, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joseph Glassrud. I am the Big Stone County attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. The appellant raises two issues, each without merit, which I will discuss very briefly. First, as to the adequacy of the factual basis, this was, and the respondent agrees, this was never a Norgaard plea, because it wasn't a Norgaard situation. It's not a case of the judge and counsel missing something in district court. It's just a case of getting a factual basis. Although
Mr.
the defendant,
yes. Glassrud, good morning. I just follow up a little bit on that point. Would you agree that there may be situations, and this one may give rise to that, where it would behoove the court to inquire about a potential Norgaard anytime you have an factual basis, I don't remember. And it sounds like this was kind of weaved in and out of remembering and not remembering. And it strikes me as, at least in my experience, oftentimes I would inquire of counsel when that starts to happen. Is this either it's because there's a denial? That's more typical as the Alford situation, but here a Norgaard might even be a break and allow the attorneys to talk to develop a Norgaard. So the point being, it sounds like you agree with appellant that one can't slide from an unintentional Norgaard to a Norgaard unless the court acknowledges it. Is that correct?
Well, it would need to meet the essential elements of a Norgaard under case law. And the state is not arguing that it would. Or that it was ever intended to. Now, could it be advisable for a district court to suggest a Norgaard basis in some situations? Perhaps, but in this situation, in this case, the defendant really didn't say there was that much he couldn't remember. And in fact, one of the things he says on page 13 of the transcript, he didn't say, I don't remember. He said, I didn't remember any of this, but I woke up and the officer was at the door. Past tense, didn't remember, So at some point, he didn't remember what happened. But in context, with everything he said, bits and pieces that were essential to the factual basis came back to him, namely dragging the victim by her hair.
Just to follow up a bit then, yes. Mr. Glaser, would you agree then, since we're not in Norgaard and everybody agrees with that, then the issue rises and falls on the words stated by the appellant. In other words, you did make reference at some point to a phrase, I think, that the Trott court had used of judicially accepted. But then you would be suggesting we're getting back into Norgaard's situation. We start looking outside of the words and into the record. And in that case, as I recall, the court said that in part of a same sentence where the trial court had carefully inquired of the facts, interrogated the, I think was the phrase used, the actual defendant. We don't have that here. So are you satisfied that your position is the record by his admission, notwithstanding that past tense, I forgot, satisfies the elements of assault harm or assault fear?
Your Honor, maybe I'm not quite understanding the question. Are you inquiring as to the state's brief regarding State v. Genero?
I'm sorry, the main point I just wanted to clarify is, since everybody's agreeing it's not a Norgaard situation, in a Norgaard we typically would look outside at the entire record, and typically there's an acknowledgement, and that's why everyone's agreeing there was no acknowledgement of the record. So we will rely on the statements of the appellant alone, I presume, to determine whether accuracy is met.
Well, Your Honor, the respondent's argument to that is there's certainly proper factual basis based on the words in the plea on the record, and that would be adequate. However, in the alternative, the state's argument is that the court can and should consider the record, namely the facts in the complaint, to supplement and contextualize what's being discussed and what's being pled to.
But maybe that's then more focused on my question. Isn't it true, though, the record here, there's no acknowledgement by the appellant of any specific facts in the in the complaint? In fact, at times there seems to be contrary statements to some of the allegations in the complaint. So, and the complaint was not offered, as I understand, as an exhibit.
It was not offered as an exhibit. That would, in the state's view, be a formality. When it's in the record, the defendant's reviewed it with his attorney, the court has it, and it was it was reviewed very soon before the hearing by the court and the parties. But I suppose what I'm I believe I reference in the state's brief that defendant clearly made reference to the complaint. He said, I believe he said, I don't remember hitting her multiple times at one point. And the reason that he's mentioning multiple times, that wasn't mentioned at the hearing. Multiple times is in the complaint. So this is a defendant who's in control of his faculties, fully cognizant of the complaint. And although he may have minimized his responsibility or claimed a lack of memory of some things, he said he may have hit the victim one time, but he didn't remember hitting her multiple times. The state does, in the alternative, contend that the court can consider the record in its entirety, and that appears to be in line with the previous Court of Appeals case law, such as Sanchez v. State.
Counsel, if we consider only his testimony at the plea hearing, what would you suggest we look to on with regard to assault harm to establish that pain can be inferred from the record?
Well,
the pulling of the hair?
Harm is, but harm includes physical pain, of course, and grabbing someone by the hair with force to drag them out of a house is an inherently painful act. From the action, it's elementary, and the court should view it as axiomatic that this is an abusive and degrading act of a physical violence to drag a woman out the door, down some stairs, as a means of getting her out of the house. And such an act has to be an assault. It's inherently assaultive. So what we see described by the defendant in his plea colloquy is something that's assault because dragging a person that way is inherently painful for anyone with hair, frankly. And it's also assault because aside from the assault harm statute, it's assault because the intent is obvious that the appellant didn't herd the victim out of the residence or didn't gently but firmly escort her out. It should really go without saying that this is an act that the defendant knew and intended to cause the victim fear of what would happen if she doesn't go where he's dragging her. But either way, certainly anyone would know that dragging a person by their hair is going to cause physical pain. It's inherently painful, and it's not an accident to grab someone by their hair versus another body part. And although another reference was made to grabbing a victim by her hand, whether that was in addition to or a misstatement doesn't really matter, that statement doesn't negate dragging by the hair. In addition, the state would still contend, as noted in the brief, that the defendant also struck the victim and essentially, although he was minimizing it by saying, I could have hit her once, but I don't remember hitting her multiple times. The reasonable inference for any fact finder, including the judge, when establishing a factual basis, is that means, yes, he hit her. With a reasonable inference, with common sense, that's exactly what the court should consider in light of what's in the complaint.
So, Mr. Glaster, if I may turn to the competency issue.
Yes, I was just about to. Yes.
So, I'm looking specifically at the question that defense counsel asked after kind of eliciting the testimony that he had been in the mental hospital with seeing a psychiatrist and was taking this medication. And that question, though, would you agree with me, it does not refer to competency. He asked, with his counseling and with counseling and medication, do you feel like you're making a rational decision today? I would feel more comfortable with this even if the question had been, if you're able to make a decision today. But that question doesn't get to the ability to make a decision. It just gets to whether the appellant thought it was a rational decision. Would you agree that that question doesn't get to the competency issue?
Well, Your Honor, the exact verbiage may not have asked the question, but that's clearly what the question means in context. And the defendant is very clear through all the questions about what he wants to do and why he wants to do it, because he wants to take advantage of the plea agreement, the same as any defendant pleading guilty anywhere in this state. So I suppose, even if the wording was inartful, it's clear what's being got at, and it's even what I believe the appellant's attorney at the hearing got at. So this is all leading to one thing that we're trying to determine. All these questions lead to one question.
But you would agree with me that at least there was never, after these issues have been raised about seeing a psychiatrist and about mental health, there was competency was never explicitly inquired into by either the judge or counsel. Is that fair to say?
Your Honor, I believe so, and I'll just take a quick look at my transcript, but that sounds accurate, that after the plea petition and that questioning from defense counsel, that was accepted by the court as sufficient.
I want to follow up just a bit to that same question. It reminds me a bit of commitment hearings we have, and usually anyone with any actual diagnosis of mental illness may believe they're the most rational person in the room, notwithstanding the facts of the conduct which supports the diagnosis. And so that seems to be the heart of Judge Jessen's question. Wouldn't the follow-up question best be, why do you think it is? And the reason I ask that is here, I understand there was no agreements, were there, that would on its face suggest rationality? Didn't he plead straight to the felony? And so, in other words, we don't have the why does he believe that, notwithstanding his mental health history. And certainly the answer may have been the one we would all like to see. Well, I want to take responsibility for what I did, but we'd have that, and then we'd be there. But aren't we missing that answer of why, notwithstanding the mental health history, you wish to do this today, enter in a guilty plea? And isn't that important and in fact required?
Well, what is asked on page 12 is, with counsel and medication, do you feel you're making a rational decision? Yes, I do. Do you feel, and then the next question, feel like you know what your alternatives are? And defendant says, yep. Defendant and defense counsel had went through the plea petition. I should add that except for the label of schizophrenic, which attached later in the pre-sentence investigation, nothing in this record contradicts the fact defendant was successfully treated with base, and we cannot and should not assume that a person with a mental health diagnosis who's treating for it, medicating for it, says he's making a rational decision, is able to converse rationally and explain the facts as he recalls them, explain the medications he's taking. There's nothing to say that person cannot waive his rights. That would be really to diminish people who live with mental illness. And to find that the appellant has met his burden on appeal, you would need something more than the existence of something that's diagnosed, treated, and managed. And you don't have anything more than the term schizophrenia, because there's really nothing else in the record that the appellant can point to. So based on the limited issues before the court, that would conclude the respondent's argument, and unless there are further questions.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you. Any rebuttal from the appellant?
Just briefly, Your Honor, I wanted to have at least point out that if the court decides to reverse Mr. Wachter's guilty plea, I think that we should also talk about what a remand looks like. If the court reverses on the factual basis issue, I'm hoping that the decision can at least, even if it doesn't reach the second issue, still direct the district court judge to engage in a thoughtful inquiry about the impact of appellant's diagnosis for schizophrenia on his ability to either stand trial, or if the case resolves in a guilty plea, so that at least the district court has some guidance on where some deficiencies may have laid, even if the basis for reversal is on the factual basis issue alone. I know sometimes the decisions decide on one issue and don't decide all of the issues if one is determinative and reaches the same outcome. So I'm hoping that the decision can at least provide some guidance to the district court on the mental health issue, because it's something that, in reviewing a lot of transcripts, is something that I think is often overlooked. And I hope that we can, with this decision, engage a little bit more focus on the mental health issues, which is really common amongst criminal defendants in this state. Otherwise, I didn't speak much about the accuracy issue in my principal argument. I definitely wanted to give the court an opportunity to ask any additional questions about the first issue. But otherwise, I'm satisfied with asking the court. Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Whittall, as Mr. Glazard pointed out, and it seems reasonable inference if we presume, at least from the statements made of admission, dragging her by her hair, if we focus on the general intent assault, because I understand, at least looking at the record, it's unclear which assault was the intention to admit to, but the general intent to cause harm or certainly attempt to cause harm, would that not be a reasonable inference from his admission, therefore sufficient to support that element?
No, Your Honor. The fact that he grabbed her hair and or her hand definitely goes to the general intent that it was an intentional act that he made contact with her, but that's not evidence of the harm. Evidence of the harm would be an observation of the police officer indicating that she said that her head hurt, or I mean, I don't know if this is too grotesque, but when the officer arrives, the defendant is standing there with a handful of hair or a bald spot on her head or redness on her face or evidence of bodily harm. A statement would be sufficient. Even testimony from appellant, she said it hurt, would be sufficient to draw the inference that she experienced physical pain or some bodily injury to meet the definition of bodily harm. But the fact remains that holding somebody's hair, at least under these circumstances here, dragging her does not permit the court to draw the inference that it led to bodily harm, because the physical pain or the injury would be too far attenuated from the very basic facts that exist that can be inferred from appellant's testimony. There would have to be some evidence that that the victim experienced pain rather than the attenuated inference that respondent is presenting, which is she could possibly have felt pain from the act described. So without more evidence, I do not think it would be appropriate to infer bodily harm, even under the general intent crime for domestic assault.
Counsel, just following up on Judge Sleater's question for a second. Here, I think the plea hearing testimony indicates that she resisted leaving the house, that he pulled her by her hair and dragged her down the stairs. Under State v. Nelson, the standard is whether regarding accuracy, the question is whether facts exist from which defendant's guilt of the crime charge can be reasonably inferred. So given those facts of her resisting, him pulling her by the hair and dragging her down the stairs, why isn't that sufficient? Why aren't those facts sufficient to reasonably infer pain in this circumstance? I think anyone who's had their, well, anyway, go ahead.
I acknowledge that pulling your hair really hard can hurt. Pulling your hair not hard doesn't hurt. And I think there needs to be evidence about the force that was used when Mr. Wachter was pulling your hair. And because it doesn't talk about, the record doesn't discuss how hard he pulled her hair, there is insufficient evidence to conclude that she felt pain or experienced an injury, a temporary loss of function, or any of the other ways that bodily harm can be satisfied without more. And I also want to point out that I can't remember exactly what Nelson is about, but all of those cases that talk about reasonable inferences are the cases where the defendant didn't openly acknowledge that it was his express mens rea intent to effectuate the result, and inferences are drawn from the record to satisfy something that is typically accomplished through rational inferences, which is the mens rea, because I think courts often overlook asking the defendant the flat out question, did you intend or did you have the requisite mens rea to accomplish this crime? And that's where cases like, I presume Nelson probably addresses that too, but I'm not aware of any cases where the court has inferred a degree of injury from one statement that he pulled her hair. There's certainly no evidence that Mr. Wachter accomplished the dragging by only her hair, especially when the record indicates that he pulled her out by her hand as well. So I don't think it's fair to infer bodily harm under these circumstances, even from the record that we have here today. We'd ask this court to reverse Mr. Walker's conviction, either under the accuracy prong or the insufficiency of the inquiry into his competence. And I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you both for your arguments today and for your briefs. We really appreciate your helpful arguments here today. And the case will be, we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.